Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
We're very happy to welcome you here for this weekend. I want to start by asking about this film, about the incredible impact and reaction to Bonnie and Clyde. I really think it's one of the very few, maybe two or three most influential American films in terms of how it changed everything, how it changed the course of cinema of the past, I would say, of the past 30 years. It was, when it opened, it drew an incredibly mixed and often violent reaction. It was attacked quite viciously at first in the New York Times, for example, which called it, Bosley Crowther was then the film critic, and he called it callous and callow, and was ashamed that the film was representing us in the Montreal Film Festival. There was an incredible exchange of letters back and forth, pro and con, in the New York Times. The Times actually changed their tone towards the film. Vincent Canby had a very favorable interview and profile of the film later that year. And by the end of the year, this was a movie that was one of the major box office hits. It made $22 million. It was Warner Brothers' biggest box office hit of the decade. It, as we said, got 10 Academy Award nominations. So could you just talk a little bit about what the immediate impact was when this movie came out?
Well, that was essentially it. It was Bosley Crowther. It was, you know, the major critic of the New York Times. And what we know about critics is that they tend around the country to slavishly follow whatever the New York Times has to say. So that an enormous number of critics lined right up behind Bosley Crowther and decided that this was irresponsible violence. Now, it all started, actually, because Bosley Crowther had a campaign going before this film opened about violence in American films. I don't know what he was referring to, but there may have been some violent films. What happened was that he was up at the Montreal Film Festival where we opened this film, simply covering the festival, not as a critic. And after seeing this film, he's somebody I knew, because he had... I guess part of the reason for his great outrage at me was that he had hailed me after The Miracle Worker as the new hope of the American cinema, I guess. Now I was the disappointed prodigal son, you see. So he turned around and just said he was going to be absolutely merciless about the film, and he was. What happened as a result of that was that we got advertising we could never have afforded. Because he would write one story, and then people would write letters, and then he would respond to that, to those letters, and then pretty soon we had ourselves, you know, $100,000 worth of advertising in the New York Times, pro and con, mostly pro. And that's what he couldn't quite figure out. So that at the end of the year, not only were we the biggest grossing film in Warner Brothers history, or in that decade, but Bosley Crowther was out of a job.
Of course, there had been violent films before that, but what was really amazing and kind of groundbreaking about this movie was the tone. The fact that it had two incredibly charismatic stars, that there was mixed in with this incredibly graphic and impactful violence was an upbeat tone. There was banjo music. It was a movie that we clearly enjoyed. So the ending, there's an incredible jump in tones in the ending.
It's more than that, I think. I think it's a romantic film, for one thing, and that's very appealing about it, now that I see it in retrospect. The other, of course, is the major part of the film, which we could never have predicted, was that this was in 68, it came out in 68, I guess, about the end of 67, mm-hmm. and came out onto the American public in 68. 68 was a very tough year in terms of the social and cultural upheaval in the country, and so the identification with these two people was enormous. And it spread. It was true in all of Western Europe as well. When Warren and I flew over to London to think we were going to go over there to publicize the film, we went walking down the street and there was everybody dressed as Bonnie and Clyde. It was absolutely bizarre. And it was that way all through Western Europe, through the Scandinavian countries and France. It was an absolutely... But all of that was unpredictable. Somebody then came up to me afterward and said, could you do another film now where you change the fashions? You know.
One of the reports from London about this film compared the mood and the euphoria of how the Bonnie and Clyde feel when they're committing their murders to a pot party, kind of the high experience by the counterculture of a pot party. And one of the letters in the New York Times said that this was not a movie for adults, that it was really for kids. So how much, I mean, obviously this there was something that hooked into the counterculture movement at the time.
Yeah, it did. It really did. And I don't know, I mean, all those kind of reference points are kind of nutty. I mean, the movie spoke to the audience. It was clear. It would have made probably double that much money if Warners had had any faith in it, but they didn't. They when we showed it to them, the literal expression of their opinion was, this is a piece of shit.
Warner Brothers the next year produced The Green Beret, so... I want to talk. There was an incredible group of people of creative talent involved with this film, and one of the most important was the producer, Warren Beatty. This was the first movie that this was a movie that really made him a huge star, and he had worked for you just a few years before in Mickey One, and now he produced this movie, and showed an incredible genius, I think, in who we brought together, and also in understanding what his image, I mean, the kind of impact
I think
that he would
true.
Have. Could you talk about Warren Beatty as a producer?
Oh, as a producer, I think Warren is probably the smartest person in all of Hollywood. I think he's the most knowledgeable producer that there is. Nobody can hold a candle to him. He's better informed about films and how they're made, how they're distributed, and why, than probably any combination of studio heads that you could put together. He's made it his practice to know that much about film. So it was a very felicitous arrangement. I had made a film with him before called Mickey One, where we jointly produced it. That is, my company had three quarters of that picture, and he had one quarter. On Bonnie and Clyde, he had three quarters, and I had one quarter. about which I'm not complaining for one second. He produced an extraordinary film here. Let me think. What else about the people in it?
Also some of the other people you work with. I mean, Robert Benton, David Newman.
Yeah, well, Benton and Newman had been working on this script for a number of years. It had gone to Truffaut at one point, it had gone to Godard at another point. Godard said he was going to shoot it in about 2 weeks in Texas, and I think that sent Benton and Newman screaming out of there. I don't know what happened with Truffaut, but something.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, I think that Truffaut rewrote the script. That's really what it is, into a Truffaut script, and Benton and Newman didn't like that. So Warren bought the original script from Benton and Newman and then came to me about it. And that was it.
Yeah. And what could you tell us about how the very unique, and at that time very groundbreaking tone of the film came about? I mean, how much of that was in the script? How much of it developed?
Some of it was in the script. Some of it we developed along the way. At a certain point in the making of the film, a very good screenwriter named Robert Towne came into it, but not making a really major change in the film at all. The special scene that Towne wrote was the scene where they go back to visit Bonnie's mother and family. That scene about you live 3 miles down the road from us and you won't live long. That was a significant scene of Towns. Warren had worked briefly with Gene Hackman in Lilith. Very tiny part. And I didn't know Gene Hackman as a film actor. I'd seen him on Broadway, it turned out, in a comedy, Any Wednesday. But I hadn't. I just simply hadn't put the two images together. Mm. But Warren showed me those 5 minutes, and that absolutely persuaded me. And then Estelle, I knew, and I just had one of those instincts that she had to play that part. She just had to. Mm. So the only part we had any difference about was Bonnie. And Warren was concerned that he felt he needed a big movie star with him. So he talked about Jane Fonda, he talked about Natalie Wood. At a certain point, we decided that Tuesday Weld could do it. And I took the script I sent it to her, and she turned it down. And it... that was the end of her marriage, because it was her husband's advice to not do it. The ways are filled with all kinds of adventures around a movie. You know, it's such big time stuff. You know, that when a picture like this takes off, as it did, it changed lives, it changed careers, it changed everything in with the people involved. It made Dunaway a star overnight, literally. And she'd been in one movie before that, and in the New York Theater, which is where I had seen her in After the Fall, Arthur Miller's play, After the Fall.
You talk a bit about the way you use music here, because music becomes very important in this film, and Little Big Man has a similar kind of counterpoint use of music, and of course Alice's Restaurant is a film that you based on a song and was inspired by a song.
Yeah, as Arlo said to me, "Hey, man, we made the first music video." the history of movie music, and there are all kinds of cases that can be made. There were many, many superb composers who wrote beautiful music. Bernard Herrmann, certainly, and many others. And that music was in support of the emotion of the film and the tonality of the film. Let me go back just a little ways technically. One of the problems in the early days of sound films was that the recordings were bouncing all over the place. I mean, the levels, the quality of the recording, if you recorded on this corner of the stage in the studio, you got one kind of sound. You record it over here, you got another kind of sound. So with all of these disparate tonalities in the dialogue sound, what they had was from beginning to end music. And I mean, that's if you look at any of the films of the 30s and 40s, it's without stop. Now we get into the 50s, and really it was not really, no, it was even later than that. It was in the early 60s when really electronic equipment took an enormous jump, and people were able to record much better, and then post-production was able to filter out and balance out sound in a remarkable way. So all the while that there had been sort of wall-to-wall music in films, now it began to be selective. I remember when I made The Miracle Worker, which was in 61, I believe, 61, we could what we call mix at the end of a picture. We could not put together sound and music and sound effects except a full reel at a time. So that if you, and the full reel is about 10 minutes. So that if you went along in a reel trying to mix it and got it just right, except at 9 minutes and 30 seconds somebody screwed up and turned up a knob wrong, it meant you had to go back and do it all over again. It was it was like a 6 or 8 week project just to mix 9 or 10 reels. So that, as for instance, when you have a scene like the scene in the middle of Bonnie and Clyde where C.W. Moss is in the car and they go in to rob the bank and then he sees a parking place. And he goes, I'll park. I can really drive. I can park. So he parks the car. Well, the idea of that, of course, is to disarm the audience, set you into a kind of panic, start with a comic scene. Out come Bonnie and Clyde. They can't find the car. Then they find the car. Now they try to get C.W. Moss to pull out of this parking place. And all the while, the music is going right up against it. It's not going, hey, be scared. Hey, what are we going to do? How do we get out of here? Not at all. It's going, flat out, flatten Scruggs. And the idea was to build this into a kind of comic scene that disarms you, and away they go, and boom, a guy comes out of the bank, jumps on the running board, and Warren, in panic, turns and shoots. And that's the first murder. And that begins the rest of their lives as Bonnie and Clyde. So, that's a long answer to a question about music. But for instance, in Little Big Man, which some of you will see tomorrow, it's a film about the American Indian. But essentially what I ended up doing was using blues. A one voice, one guitar blues singer, player. On the assumption that any genuinely ethnic sound is perfectly valid, and there's no more fabulous sound in the world than blues. And I thought that that was a wonderful sound for the quote American Indian. So instead of dum 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 dum, which Warner's and every other studio out there had used to death for the films. Anyway, it was interesting. When that picture came out, nobody, no critic, wrote about the music. I think they were scared to touch it by that point.
You talk about complexity, about how you use the music to add complexity, and I want to talk about how you do that with performances, with the actors. I read an old interview with you where you talked about John Ford and said that you didn't think he was as good a director as he was. You didn't think he was a great director of actors because you always knew how the types were going to act. The cowboy would act a certain way. The barkeeper would act a certain way. And there's an incredible nuance and surprise in the performances we see here.
Yeah, I should, however, have amended that to say that when he did The Quiet Man, he got some beautiful performances. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, Ford, philosophically, was working from a quite different perspective about the American hero than I was. And he, consequently, in support of that very affirmative feeling he had about the, quote, American hero, he had a bunch of cohorts, all of whom had very distinct functions. You know, one of whom had to get too drunk and spoil things and then get punched in the jaw. And, you know, I mean, that's what Ward Bond was born for. and Victor McLaughlin before him, you know. That and the Un-American Activities Committee. So the configuration around his hero, and with all due respect to John Wayne, acting is not one of his strong suits. Huh? I mean, he's got a lot of other characteristics, but I wouldn't, out of a lineup of American actors, pick him as a particularly distinguished character. That's what I meant about Ford. I meant that you knew the types, and he had that little team of actors, and inevitably they would all be there. Mm-hmm. I don't remember the names of all of them, but I remember the Ward Bond and those guys. Mm-hmm. So that's all I meant.
Yeah.
Ford was a brilliant filmmaker. He's absolutely brilliant, but he wasn't concerned about complexity in his actors. He wanted rather simplicity in his actors. He was working with a kind of two-dimensional personalities in a multi-dimensional film.
There's a way that the 70s is, and the late 60s in cinema is so different than today, and that you were able to make films that offer very complex views of American society. And when I was thinking of what the other influential films were that really changed Hollywood, not all of them in a positive way, the other one, aside from Bonnie and Clyde, that I thought of was Star Wars, as a movie that in the mid-70s set the tone, I think, for what was going to come afterwards. And one thing it did was kind of lower the intelligence age level of the audience, but I think it might have made it hard when everything you had to make after that was a huge blockbuster to make films that were challenging and complex.
Oh, I think unquestionably that changed
the
nature of American films. I don't think they've recovered, really, as of yet. I think they may be on their way up again, and there's still some vital signs left in the patient. But I don't think the film, as an interesting and complex and even literate medium, recovered from that period of special effects,
mm-hmm.
The Lucas Spielberg onslaught. All that happened is they got very rich.
I want to let people. I wanted to talk about some of your other films, but before we jump off of Bonnie and Clyde, I want to see if people in the audience have questions. So, right down here.
Why would a producer go to Truffaut or Godard for something as a slice of Americana, which this picture was? It's an odd choice.
Yeah. I guess it was. It wasn't Warren. It wasn't Beatty who went to them. It was the scriptwriters. I guess they identified themselves with as they thought of it as sort of nouvelle vague writers. You know, a part of the new wave of film. And indeed, that is inherent in the script, that there is a new tonality, a new address to film, to the organization of film. But on the other hand, that they would have both been tragic errors in my perspective. On the other hand, Godard, after this film came out, speaking to a bunch of cinema buffs out in Hollywood, said, "All right, now let's go out and make Bonnie and Clyde the right way." So his arrogance is impenetrable.
In the context of the Depression, it's either the murderer, his hero, or you have people taking life, the state, and you have the criminal, and there isn't much to choose on a moral level between them.
Sure. It didn't have a national jurisdiction. Jurisdiction in the case of criminals like this was limited to the state, so that if they commit, as Clyde says, when she gives him the chance to say how he would live life over again, he says, "I'd live in one state and work in the other." Well, what happened was, and this is an example of the venality and devilishness of J. Edgar Hoover. What he did was he took this group of Midwestern bank robbers, small, very small potatoes at best in terms of criminality, and elevated them to the level of public enemy number one, number two, number three. And that was the case with Bonnie and Clyde, with Pretty Boy Floyd, with John Dillinger, with one after another. And the purpose of that was that he could knock those guys off, that, and by doing so he could elevate his agency from being a specifically small agency into a national police force, which in effect he did. It was on the backs of these rather small-time bucolic criminals that he elevated the FBI. They even had at a certain point a comic book put out in which the exploits of these terrible bandits were elevated to that level, and then the great big brave G-man came along and knocked them off. Well, that's the way it went. And we know from our own history that is literally the case. To the end of J. Edgar Hoover's entire life, He kept denying that there was a mafia in America. But there were these kinds of criminals. These criminals and communists were the targets of the FBI as he constructed it. So I was going to undo some of that. And what I was really talking about was that these were bumpkins. They were really, all of these guys, Dillinger, Bonnie and Clyde, Pretty Boy Floyd, yes, they were antisocial types, no question about it. They were killers. But they were, more than anything, they were bumpkins in terms of reasoning. And their view was, well, the banks hold the mortgages. Now the banks are foreclosing on us. So we, in order to get back at the banks, are going to go rob them. And that's where we started out at the very beginning in this film, with a bank that had already gone broke. Because it was true. The banks were going broke out of a kind of foolishness on their own, which was, there's no middle ground. If we hold the mortgage and you can't pay the mortgage, then we're going to shut you down. We're going to take your farm. And then what are we going to do with it? We're going to leave it there. And that's literally what happened across America. And that was all of it, the attitude of the Depression that was encapsulated in that basic banking attitude, which was punitive, repressive, and more than anything, vengeful against people who couldn't pay. So these people sprang up all through the Midwest.
Hi, Arthur.
Hi. I'm missing your mustache.
Throughout the last 10 or 20 years of going to the movies, as I would see, like, the end of The Wild Bunch or films not done so well, I'd say to myself, oh, yeah, like Bonnie and Clyde, like bullet hits, all these bullet hits. I'm amazed now, seeing this film 25 years later, that there aren't that many bullet hits, and I'm looking, I think, at a lot of acting selling this death, not a lot of bullet hits. And
blessings on thee, my son. Yeah.
If you talk about how you created that, because in my mind I thought I was going to see today clothing
right.
filled with bullet hits and wires and everything, and instead I'm watching Faye Dunaway vibrate, I'm watching Warren roll there on the ground and all that. And could you talk about how that?
Well, it was literally a misinterpretation of the film that set in motion all of this idea about the violence. I went to see Pulp Fiction last night, you know? A nifty film, very good film. There's more blood in that, you know, from a woman overdosing than there is in this. What happened was that this misrepresentation of the film took place in Crowther's mind. Now, what we were doing was a much more, as I say, romantic film. It was a film intended to make up, and there's no question of the truth here. It is in no way a biographical film. It's no way is it the truth about Bonnie and Clyde. They were wretched people. But our people weren't wretched, and we were not. We were not trying to tell the story of Bonnie and Clyde. We were trying to say, in 1967, look, there's something about a youthful love and a youthful rebellion that is very attractive, that's very attractive to us, the filmmakers. And that's what we were emphasizing. And that's why it's rather lyrical, in point of fact, right before they die. They turn and look at each other, and those looks are extremely expressive, and I'll tell you about those in a minute. And then comes this death. Now, in point of actual historical fact, they did fire over 1,200 rounds at them. I mean, it was savage. It was beyond anything that anybody could ever think of as being a way of killing somebody. It was a way of making mincemeat of them, literally. I didn't intend to do that in the film, and I wasn't prepared to do that. I was prepared to do something which was to say, look, this story in a way sort of took place, and it has a kind of legendary quality. And so my first instinct was that it should be balletic. that it should have resembled something of a ballet, and that they move into legend and out of reality, quote, out of reality into legend by the change of environment, by the change of context. And that's why I ganged together all of these four cameras, all running at different speeds, photographing exactly the same action, was to be able to move inside the same action, but with a different speed for each camera. The thing about the look of one to the other, it was one of those testy periods in the course of the movie where Warren and Faye were not getting along terribly well. And in order to get those looks, I played the other part off screen. So Faye is looking at me, and then I turned around and shot Warren, and he's looking at me. And then you put them all together, and then you get that lyrical, beautiful... That's literally what happened.
Apparently they really loved you.
Well, they did, actually, and they loved it. They were not. It was not that they didn't love it. You know, actors get testy, and particularly before a shoot like this, they were anxious, because there's no question about it. I mean, it's frightening. What they do is they put... Do you know how they make these things? It's a little metal dish into which they put a small charge of gunpowder. There's a wire running to it. Then on top of that, there's a little sack, plastic sack, of blood. And then the whole thing is wrapped in a condom. And now it's strapped to your body. I mean, pasted to your body. Well, in some instances here, they had, you know, close to 100 of those on them. It doesn't always show, because they're moving... And they're moving away from camera at a certain point. But each one of those had to be rigged constantly, because we never knew what we were going to be able to see in slow motion. And so they had a bundle of very fine wires running up their legs that was about that wide. That's terrifying, as you can imagine. You got one face, you got one body, and one career based on that, and God knows what's going to go wrong here. And things did go wrong. Not things to be frightened of, fortunately, but things... I digress briefly again. The reason that we had, with four slow-motion cameras, what happens is, with the most slow-motion cameras, it's that they eat up film very fast. In other words, you achieve slow motion by exposing a greater number of frames per second. Is that clear? So that there was a sizable amount of film. Well, it was so much, and it all had to be done so carefully, because we would run out of film. I mean, it was only going to last about that long. So you couldn't say, okay, roll them, camera, action, yeah, you know. There was no way to do that. So what we did was we took... that when Warren bit into the pear, everything went. And that was the cue for everybody, all the departments, to go on all the special effects and the blood and the cameras are rolling and sound and all of that. Well, it took us all of one morning to load that thing up, and it was just before lunch. And Warren was nervous about it. And we got to that point, and everybody was there, and they were all, the set was ready to go, and Warren bit into the pear, and then he just stood there. And, of course, everything went off. I mean, a piece of his head blew off, and bullet hits all over him. He didn't roll, he didn't fall down. Faye was over there dying with death. But Warren never moved. He just stood there with a shit-eating grin on his face. I mean, and looked down at these things coming off him. So that was one of the adventures. It took 4 days to shoot that. We got a shot in the morning, shot in the afternoon. Shot in the morning, shot in the afternoon. That was it.
one of the beautifully stylized scenes is when they go to see Bonnie's mother, and that's done in slow motion. And this,
well, there's only one tiny little piece of slow motion in it.
Yeah, but more the foggy look.
The faintly foggy look, yeah.
You just talk about how that came about?
Yeah, well, that came about... every story has to have a long antecedent. I had made a picture called The Chase out there, and it was a nightmare. It was a bloody nightmare. I ran into a cameraman who was used to the old ways. And the old ways meant that you lit and lit and lit mercilessly, and then you stopped down to nothing, you know, and then you got these beautiful images, except that the actors were tired, everybody was exhausted, the cameraman was having the time of his life, but, you know, the actors were you know, hours and hours on the set waiting to go. And that was ridiculous. So, when I came to make this, I said to Bernie Guffey, Bernie, we're going to go. I'm going to go with available light, I'm going to go the way it goes. Film is so much faster now, the lenses are faster, everything works so much better. Let's just go. Let's take a chance, and if we're marginal, we'll come back and do it over again, but I want us... Well, that worked for a while. And so when we came to this family reunion scene, I said, you know, there should just be the air of an old photograph that's just beginning to turn. He said, got it. And he sent somebody into town and got a piece of screen. Just like a piece out of a screen door. Except not shiny. It was dull. And that's it. He put that in the camera, and that's all that we changed in that scene. And that and the fact that we foreshadow the slow motion with that little boy on the hill just rolling down. And then that was it. Well, so we're going along, and now we come to the scene where Estelle Parsons is blinded, you know, and it's seen in the headlights, and she's got this, my eyes, and I look up, and you know, it looks wonderful in just the headlights, and there's Bernie putting up a light over there and a light over here, and I said, hey, Bernie, no. And he said, I need it. And I said, no, I mean, I want it just the way it looks in the headlights, whether we see her or not, whether she's a... Well, it got to be very testy, that little moment. And unfortunately, I didn't know this, but he had ulcers, and he started to bleed, and he went into the hospital for 3 days after that little encounter. But... one of the things that I have to tell you about that is related to that, because they are related. Those of you who have seen The Miracle Worker know the story. Now, I had a Cuban cameraman named Ernie Caparos on that picture, and we're shooting in black and white. And Ernie is, you know, veteran of I don't know how many hundred films. And so we were going along about the third week of the movie. We did the last scene of the movie, which is a very emotional, terribly upsetting scene. And Annie pulls Helen out of the house. They go to the pump. She's been spelling into her hand, and all of a sudden, it hits. And it's an electrifying moment. It was electrifying on the stage for 200 performances. And there we are shooting, and there's a whole crew is standing around crying, you know, these great big hulks, you know, sobbing like a bunch of babies. Well, Caparos could tell from that we were on to something. He didn't know the play. He had never gone to see the play. He didn't pay any attention to it. But he saw the effect of that, and all of a sudden he could see Academy Award. And we go on shooting now the other part of the film, and I say, let's go, Ernie, come on, let's go. He says, I have to light the charros. I said, you're what? He said, do you look a Rembrandt? He lights charros. we have one of these discussions in the middle of the picture. Well, that's what happens, is they get an intimation of immortality. And peculiarly enough, with Bernie Guffey, he won the Academy Award. Ernie got nominated, actually. But what it does to the director is it eats up your life, because one of the big things about directing a film that's never out of your head is, I've got so much time and so much money, and this is where I'm going to spend it, and I got to move on. I got to get this by 11 o'clock because I got this ahead of me. And you know, that's going in your head like the world's biggest taxi meter. And you can't allow any of that to go awry. You're in charge of this great big thing that costs that much. So when suddenly somebody waxes poetic, and somebody is your cinematographer, you got to take him over into the bushes and say, you know, enough of that crap. Come on, buddy, let's go do it. No, I don't actually do that. I don't, except with the last scene, the big shooting scene. That was one I planned beforehand. But ordinarily, I don't plan a scene at all until we're on the set, until the actors are really playing the scene. Because there are so many wonderful discoveries that actors make that I find... The whole idea of a director coming in and sort of saying, now you be there, and then on this line you move over here, and I'll have the camera over there. And all of that, which I did for years in live television, because there was no alternative to that. We had no tape. We were simply going out on the air live, and so we had to do that. I find that as an offensive idea, and one that doesn't allow the actors the wonderful luxury of discovery that they very often make. In Bonnie and Clyde, that wonderful moment where Faye says to C.W. Moss, we rob banks. And he turns and looks at her and starts to laugh, and then walks back toward the, you know, looks back at her again, keeps laughing. All of that was just an actor's moment. And I just let the camera run. And I was set up for that, but it had come about in a rehearsal, and it's constantly the case that the actors invent, and it's far better, I think, to follow their inventive lead with the visualization, because the visualization is as much a part of the dramatic motion of a scene as anything. Where the camera is at a given moment, when a scene moves to a degree of dramatic intensity, is enormously important. And I find that the actors' instincts for those are impeccable. So I follow their lead.
In terms of your visual style, Robert Altman's another director who does ensemble work like you do, but one thing that you do differently in your visual style is that there's a real immediacy. You use close-ups a lot more, and point of view shots, where you'll show us what the character sees. You'll take the time to do that. I wonder if you could just talk about that, because that's something that seems a little bit different than what you would do as a theater director, obviously. Just,
yeah, you know, okay.
Theater. So if you could just talk about that visual stuff.
One of the problems in the theater is that you're close-up starved, you know? Right. One of the thrills about getting into film was that there was the close-up. And... I guess I'm different from a lot of those guys, from Bob Altman, certainly because of my theater experience. I have no sort of discomfort handling a large crowd scene or a large scene. That's relatively easy for me. It's that when I want to take you out of that and into the emotion or the intensity of it, I tend to go up close. Bob tends to stay back and let the scene act itself out in a brilliant way. I mean, there's no better filmmaker that I know of, and it's a terrific way of telling a story. John Ford did the same thing very often, told the intense moment of a film in a rather loose shot. Those of us who came out of live TV tend not to do that. Lumet. Well, I don't know. I can't make that generalization because Frank Schaffner did do that. George Roy Hill falls in between somewhere. Frankenheimer is more on my kind of style. So, but that's where I think the genesis of it was.
The actress in the scene who plays your mother, was she, when I first see her, I think, she's somebody found down there in Texas or something. But then she delivers that line. It's just incredible, whatever, you know.
Yeah. You live 3 miles from me, honey, and you won't live long.
Could you talk about who she was and directing her to get that line up?
She was a school teacher from Texas who was standing standing on the side while we were shooting a scene. And my associate, Jean Lasco, came up to me and said, "That woman looks like Faye. She looks just like Faye." And I kept looking at her, and indeed she did. So I went over to her and started talking to her. And she had this wonderful Texas accent. She was a school teacher. But she didn't have any other way of talking. I mean, she just had to talk that way, which was just fine with me. And so I didn't even really rehearse her. I just waited until the moment we were ready to shoot, and we shot. And she just talked. And that was it.
There's amazing performances by Pat Quinn and James Broderick in Alice's Restaurant, and you can't really tell if they're professional or not professional. I mean, they seem like incredibly natural performances, and I assume that film has a lot of non-actors mixed in.
Yeah, Arlo.
But Pat Quinn in particular is fantastic.
Well, Pat Quinn is a wonderful actress.
Yeah.
She's a wonderful actress. She didn't pursue her career, but she started out as a secretary to us, to Fred Cohen and me, and then she allowed one day as how she was really an actress, and then it turned out she was a very fine actress, and I brought her out to California to be in The Chase, and then she met Brando.
What's your feeling now about Alice's Restaurant, which was your next film after Bonnie and Clyde, and which actually holds up incredibly well because it's it's really one of the best documents of that period? How does your feeling about seeing it now change from when it was made?
Well, I remember now that more than other films did have a lot of non-actors in it. The police chief was the same police chief who busted Arlo, and Arlo and a number of people in the film were the real people. Quote. I look back on it with a certain pride, actually, because I had a feeling that that whole period had to be documented in some way. And there were a lot of attempts. I can't even begin to remember the titles of them, but every studio in the country was making a counterculture hippie film, and none of them survived except Alice's. That's the only one that I think has lasted with any kind of vividness. It's a film I'm quite proud of. It occurred to me when a friend of Arlo's brought over the record right after it was issued and said, "Hey, have you, you know," because we live in Stockbridge, which is where the whole thing happened. I mean, it couldn't have been more fortuitous. It was literally right outside our door, practically. So I heard the record, and I thought, gee, there's someone there. And then the next night, we went to a dinner party, a much older crowd, and they played the record again. And I thought, if these people are listening to it, and the kids are listening to it, there's something here. And of course, there was. There was enormous wit and a very salient and sharp perception about the nature of morality as it was being used by authoritative figures. And I find it a picture I enjoy a lot. With Penn and Teller?
Yes.
We met, we just met and started talking, and I thought, gee, these guys are in some way remarkable. And they are. I don't think the film is any good, but that's my fault. I blew it. I was trying to make a pop film about I don't know, middle class values, I guess. But doing it with magicians is the dumbest thing in the world, because you know, there's no magic. Everybody knows after a whole decade of Spielberg and Lucas, you know, nothing is magical. It's all either a movie trick, so it doesn't have the effect that Penn and Teller have in the theater, where they do these wonderful things. Or, I mean, while Teller is in the tank drowning, apparently, while Penn goes off on a rap about some social event or political event, because he was in the middle of a card trick that involves Teller going into this tank and coming up with the right card, and right before your eyes, Teller is in this tank dying, you think, and Penn is rapping about the outcome of the election and going on and on and on, and you think, my God, what about that guy in the tank? Oh, God. And then, of course, the end of the trick is he's got the card inside of his mask. I mean, they're brilliant in the theater. It didn't work on film. It didn't work. Happens.
Is it by design or coincidence that your films reflect what seems to be a sort of generous liberal spirit politically, or is that just coincidence of something about you?
Well, that's a self-description, I think, of me. I think I am. And consequently, I'm a very disappointed voter. Well, every time now I turn on the television today, and there was Newt Gingrich every place you looked.
Did you come upon Gene Wilder?
Oh, I'd seen that. Gene Wilder is a wonderful actor, and he's been around for, he's been in the theater as a very serious actor. And I had I'm very involved with the Actors Studio. In fact, at the moment, I'm the president of it. And we had a unit there called the Playwright and Directors Unit. And the guy who wrote The Great White Hope, how his name could go out of my head at this point is. Anyway, he wrote a little playlet that Gene Wilder and Zero Mostel did that was as funny as anything I had ever seen in my life. But here was Wilder. He couldn't get arrested as a comic actor, you know? But from having seen that scene, I knew that he was perfect for it. So it was just, there was no question in my mind when I read the script. I mean, it was one of the casting on that picture was really one of those blessings where everybody sort of jumped out, with the exception of Hackman, because I didn't know him in that light. But C.W. Moss, Michael Pollard, and all these other folks were people I knew and knew well. And Denver Pyle, the sheriff, had been in Left-Handed Gun. So it was just one of those joyful pictures in that respect.
Say that Little Good Man was the ending of the cowboy and Indian movies as we knew them in the 50s and 60s?
Yes, to a certain extent I did, because it took me 6 years to get that movie made, because of the inherent prejudice in Hollywood against a movie that was apparently sympathetic to the Indians. And it was perceived that way by a lot of the production offices at the studios, who then, in their sly little way, way over-budgeted the picture, so that the head of the studio, who might want to make it, was scared off from making it. And in point of fact, when we made it, 6 years after the fact, we came in $3 million under the budgeted figure, because the figure was so inflated. But Hollywood, to be absolutely kind, is a really fascist city. And they got one way of looking at history, and it's their way. The way they wrote history, and that was a very strong thing. And then lo and behold, years later, along comes Dances with Wolves.
Yep.
I don't know how you can make that after Little Big Man already exists, but they forgot. That's it. They forgot. I'm working on a couple of pictures. I did a play on Broadway years ago that I've always been delighted with called Sly Fox. It was a play based on Volpone with George C. Scott and Hector Elizondo, and it's one of the funniest plays I think that's been around. It's a farce, but it's written by Larry Gelbart, and one of the most remarkable people around. And so I ran into Harvey Weinstein the other day, who's one of the Miramax brothers, and he said, "Hey, you want to make Sly Fox?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Okay." So that's one thing on my plate. The other is a film that I'm going to make for a cable company, but it's a very good film. It's set in South Africa about the conditions in a prison while Mandela was still a prisoner in the midst of apartheid, and then after, when Mandela was released and the change in the environment.
How did you like working with Jackie Gleason?
It was terrible. Jackie Gleason was a strange man. He was a strange man. Talented without question. When he was doing what he can do, and what he can do brilliantly. You know, and away we go, and all that stuff. While he tries to play a character, as he was trying to do in Sly Fox, this was the road company of Sly Fox, where he was playing the same part that George C. Scott had played. Well, there was just no question about it. It was a no-go from the word go. It just didn't work. We couldn't. But we sold tickets like crazy. The only trouble was that he had a quintuple bypass. Is that possible? In Chicago, the second city they played in. So that we lost all those bookings and all that money. But he was a strange fellow.
Okay. We're going to have to stop. I thought we were going to stop with current projects, but instead we're going to have to end on Jackie Gleason. I want to thank Arthur Penn for coming out and being with us this weekend.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.